what happens if the president doesn't get the funding he's demanding for this wall. What are the implications for him and for the party as a whole? You mentioned that he said he would own the shutdown, yes, and then a couple of days later on Twitter said, you know, this is now over to the Democrats. So if the president doesn't get what he wants, what does that mean for him?
Noel, we're less than a week away before the beginning of the new Congress. Next Thursday, I and all of my colleagues will be sworn in again, but it'll be different. Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats will be running the House and have the majority. The Senate, though, is a different story. Republicans will grow their majority in the Senate, but it will still take 60 votes in the Senate to move something forward. So to your point, this shutdown could last a while if President Trump continues to stick to his guns. But this issue has become a very much a key base issue for Republicans. I mean, in places like where I come from, it's become one of those issues that the voters are seeing a clear difference between Republicans and Democrats when it comes to funding border security. And that happens to be really important in districts like where I come from. And I imagine it'll be a very important campaign issue in 2020 that my sense is will motivate Republican voters to vote just as much as they did in this election just a few weeks ago.
Congressman, just briefly, as you point out, this is your last week in the majority. You'll soon be under the leadership of Nancy Pelosi. What is the strategy moving forward?
Well, there are many opportunities to still get things done, especially in many of the areas where we found bipartisan support over the past couple of years. I serve on a couple of committees that are great examples of that. On the House Armed Services Committee, in a bipartisan fashion over the past couple of years, we restored funding to our military. By what was cut over the past 10 years, we saw about 20% of military spending cut. We've restored that in bipartisan fashion. I also serve on the Veterans Affairs Committee, where almost everything that we did over the past couple of years was done in bipartisan fashion, too. So I expect that there will still be opportunities to get things done. There's
to
a lot of talk
forward.
About transportation issues or infrastructure issues that we might be able to get things done too. So I'm still hopeful that the next couple of years could be productive.
All right, Republican Congressman Jim Banks of Indiana, thank you so much.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
All right, I want to bring in NPR's congressional reporter, Kelsey Snell. Good morning, Kelsey.
Good morning.
So what did you hear from Representative Jim Banks that stood out to you?
Well, he nailed something that I think I've been hearing from a lot of Republicans and Democrats alike, that this is a key base issue. Immigration and the wall in particular have become something more than a policy issue. It is a big politics issue. He talked about it being a campaign thing for 2020. It is one of those issues where voters, as he said, are seeing a clear difference on border security, because that's what the definition is coming down to. Do voters want a wall, or do they want a more nuanced conversation about ways to secure the border and fix the immigration system?
The congressman also said the shutdown could last for a while. What do we expect as we head into the new year?
That is the great mystery here. Nancy Pelosi, who will become speaker next week likely, calls this policy immoral. And when you get to a point when you're talking about morals and not just a policy issue, it becomes incredibly hard to see how Democrats move off of that. And President Trump has not signaled in any way that he wants to compromise either.
NPR's Kelsey Snell, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, the city of Detroit has reached a major milestone. 5 years ago, it went bankrupt. It was saddled with more than $18 billion in debt. Well, now Detroit is not only out of bankruptcy, but is issuing bonds backed by its own credit instead of bonds guaranteed by state government or insurers. As Quinn Kleinfelter of member station WDET reports, while the city's economy is improving, some Detroiters fear it may be leaving behind those who toughed it out when the times were bad.
Detroit shed $7 billion of debt by going bankrupt. It then restructured and declared itself open for investment. New development poured in, led by hometown businessman Dan Gilbert, who invested more than $5.5 billion in about 100 Detroit properties, moved his mortgage company and Bedrock real estate firm downtown, and is now reportedly the city's largest private employer and taxpayer. At a recent groundbreaking for a new downtown office tower backed by Gilbert, Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan marveled at just how fast the once bankrupt city is changing.
Well, isn't this an amazing week in Detroit? I mean, we started Monday with an historic commitment by the corporations to help transform Detroit neighborhoods. And 3 days later on Thursday, we're here with Dan Gilbert and Bedrock, an announcement that's going to help transform the skylight.
Moody's Investor Service analyst David Levitt says the city government is balancing its budget now, saving funds to cover pension obligations Detroit will have to resume paying in 2024. And he estimates impending job cuts in Detroit's auto industry really won't hit much of the city's workforce. But Levitt cautions that Detroit's public school system has no money to make badly needed repairs, and investors are not spreading their wealth across the city.
The growth in the city has been largely concentrated in the greater downtown area. There's still declining population if you look at the city as a whole, and the income levels are still low in the city as a whole.
And some here express concern that investment is skewed towards bringing new upscale residents downtown, neglecting the neighborhoods where most Detroiters live. The exodus from those neighborhoods has slowed to a mere trickle of what it's been over the past few decades, and in some, people are actually moving in.
Okay. Thank you for coming in.
No problem. Okay.
The Art in Motion studio and gallery sits on what's called the Avenue of Fashion, once a prime shopping area. Owner Kay Willingham says she's stayed in this neighborhood for almost 50 years. While there are crime issues, like any big city, there's also a vibrancy.
Families are moving back in, because that's one thing that had not happened. We see a lot of families that are moving in, and I think that's a great thing, because that's what this community needs. They're not afraid to get out and try something new. They're not afraid to go for a walk, take the dog out, take the kids out. Where this neighborhood for a long time, that wasn't happening.
Detroit officials are targeting hundreds of millions of dollars to build up neighborhoods already doing well, like this one. Willingham says that can be a mixed blessing.
Now we're getting ready to go into construction next year, which is a good thing. They're getting ready to take the median out. They're expanding the sidewalks, putting in bike lanes. But that's going to be a two-year process. So for a small business, that's a lot to endure to keep business going.
In other neighborhoods stretching across Detroit's 143 square miles, residents are still waiting for a rejuvenation. A soft rain is falling on heavy traffic along Jefferson Avenue, connecting a mostly barren edge of Detroit with the affluent Grosse Pointe suburbs. Detroit officials have plans to lure new business to the area, providing tax breaks, assembling parcels of land, even offering to match investors' money with grant funding. But community activist Luther Keith says too many stores here still sit empty.
To bring them back requires somebody to walk down this block of closed storefronts and say, I think we can change this. I'm going to put up the first storefront. I'm going to open the first coffee shop.
The city recently announced it will renovate two vacant buildings in the area to create new residential units, half of them affordable housing for people with low incomes. Keith says that helps offset fears among some Detroiters that the city's tearing down of tens of thousands of blighted buildings makes way for new upscale residences, while overlooking resources for those already in the neighborhoods. But he says the enduring challenges to transforming Detroit go far deeper.
The real issue in Detroit is not gentrification, it's poverty, poor people. We need jobs, we need investment, so folks can take care of themselves.
Detroit's poverty rate has dropped slightly, but almost half of Detroit children live below the poverty line. City officials say there are jobs here, and they're offering training in skilled trades, everything from construction work to database administration. Detroiter Thomas Sampson supports himself, driving for the rideshare service Lyft. As he cruises towards downtown, he says he and others like him are making Detroit's post-bankruptcy economy work for them, even if they're not the kind of new property owners the city wants to fill its tax base.
But because we have the decisions that was made,
turn left, then turn right.
And now we got all these folks that's coming down here, it enables me to do well in the rideshare program. And that's what's the most important thing about Detroit is, you know, we're strong, we're resilient. You know, when we fall, we get back up.
That's a mantra Detroit officials have adopted, too, touting the resurgence of the Motor City, moving past bankruptcy far faster than experts anticipated, but with many miles to go on the road to resurrection. For NPR News, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on WPR, right now 8:19. Later this morning, it's Wisconsin Life, and today we'll hear about comedian Charlie Behrens, host of the Manitowoc Minute. He's had a busy year. That story is in 25 minutes. Stay with us.
Wisconsin Public Radio Travel has three adventures planned for the second half of 2019. In July, we're sponsoring a holiday vacations trip to Alaska and the Inside Passage by ship, rail, and motor coach. We team again with Holiday Vacations in September for a vacation in Italy. In October, we head to South America with Fox World Travel to explore the vineyards of Argentina and Chile. Details on all three trips can be found at wpr.org/travel.
Support for WPR comes from 54,000 individuals and families in Wisconsin and beyond. Their investment in Wisconsin Public Radio enhances and extends the breadth and quality of programming available to everyone who listens. Thank you.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, mugs, books, and more. Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911.
In WPR weather, we'll have cloudy skies today. Areas of rain and mixed rain and snow will turn to all snow this afternoon. Up to 2 inches of accumulation possible in the southern part of the state, and highs in the 30s and 40s, but cooling throughout the day. On Saturday, some morning snow showers, then partly cloudy and colder, highs in the mid to upper 20s.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Airtable, a collaboration platform used by a diverse range of teams, from documentary filmmakers to cattle ranchers, for turning inspiration into innovation so teams can start building at Airtable.com. From Intuit, maker of QuickBooks, for keeping track of business expenses and receipts for deductions at tax time. Smart business tools for the world's hardest workers. QuickBooks, backing you. From Indeed, used by over 3 million businesses for hiring, where employers can post jobs and use screener questions to build their short list of preferred candidates. Learn more at indeed.com/hire. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noelle King. It's been a turbulent year for USA Gymnastics. Back in January, dozens of women testified in a Michigan courtroom. They talked about years of sexual abuse they suffered at the hands of a prominent doctor, Larry Nassar. Trinae Gonzar was one of those women.
This last year has traumatized me in ways you cannot even begin to imagine, as I've had to realize I was abused for many years of my life. And this, my old friend, is because of you.
Nassar was sentenced to decades in prison, and a succession of USA Gymnastics CEOs have since stepped down. Then this month, the organization filed for bankruptcy. I talked to Trinae Gonzar, and I asked her how she thinks USA Gymnastics is handling all of this.
I mean, I think that they've completely crumbled to their feet. I don't think that they've done anything but make one bad decision after another and completely ruin the name of the sport and the organization. It looks worse and worse every time that they make these kind of decisions.
If someone from the organization was to call you and say, Trinae, what should we do? What would you tell them to do?
Meet me. Talk to me. Meet with us. Talk to us. Learn about us. You know, I think that there's something to be said about character when you actually just say, we were wrong, how do we make this better?
You're saying essentially an apology would go a long way towards starting to heal this thing.
Truly, that is all we have ever wanted from anyone. Ever.
Despite all of this, the U.S. women's team did really well at the World Championships in Qatar a couple months ago in October. Simone Biles, the top gymnast in the world, keeps on dominating the sport. When you see the U.S. team compete and do well, how do you feel about that?
So proud. So proud. I mean, they've gone through the trenches at this stage and to continue to fight. You know, I think there's one thing about being a gymnast. Like, we're trained to face fear. So he picked on essentially the worst group of athletes to do something like this to, because we're so focused and we're so taught how to overcome fear. And I think USAG and United States Gymnastics, being the powerhouse that we are, I think just, I mean, speaks so loudly of the survivors of this case and the sport. I mean, we're little, but we're mighty. But it's when they go out of competition and that door closes, unfortunately, is when you actually see the heartbreak. And that's truly the reality for all survivors.
Let's talk about you as an individual for a moment, because I know that you've taken on sort of a role in the past year as an advocate, as an activist, but you suffered very greatly as a young woman and as a girl. Your testimony at Larry Nassar's trial was powerful. It was also agonizing. You talked for about 17 minutes. You said that for many years you had defended him, and you said that he was your friend. We're going to play a little bit of that tape, Trinae.
I never doubted you. I never felt scared of you. We loved you like family. We believed you looked out for us and protected us from harm. We literally loved you like family.
What did it mean for you to have the chance to talk directly to him in open court?
Well, that moment for me was 1,000% between he and I. It was a moment that the world saw that was extremely heartbreaking for me and, to be honest, heartbreaking for him. I never understood that this person could be the same person as the person that did this to all these girls and did so much harm. But now as I go forward, I can understand for these other amazing ladies and athletes and women how this ruined a part of their life because they didn't know him the same fashion that I knew him.
Your last words to Larry Nassar in court were, "Goodbye, Larry. May God bless your dark, broken soul." When he went to prison, did you find closure?
For me, no. For a lot of the other girls, it was a closure. For me, it was an opener. I had really not been able to start the healing process because I was still real. I was very pregnant and really trying to understand what was happening. So for me, those words were the beginning of my journey, and it's been a long one.
Trinae Gonzar, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it so much.
Trinae Gonzar works for Wayne County Safe. They work with sexual assault survivors in and around Detroit.
As Central American families continue arriving at the southern border, pushing federal immigration authorities beyond their limit, private citizens and nonprofits have been shouldering some of the responsibility. Monica Ortiz Uribe reports on the efforts of Annunciation House, a shelter organization in El Paso, Texas.
Sunday night, shelter director Ruben Garcia got a call from El Paso police about 200 people stranded outside a downtown bus station. They were Central American families dropped off by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. ICE failed to give Garcia advanced warning about the release, something the agency had been doing on a regular basis since October. Without that warning, the migrants were left out in the cold, and Garcia's organization stayed up till 3 a.m. finding housing for them.
There was a moment there where I was tempted to see if I could find buses and drive all the way to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue and say Merry Christmas.
Why ICE failed to notify Garcia remains a mystery. The agency hasn't replied to multiple requests for comment. Immigration authorities are straining to process hundreds of families arriving daily at the southern border. In the last 3 months, Garcia says Annunciation House has taken in up to 2,300 families per week. As local shelters and churches reach capacity, they've turned to hotels, racking up a monthly bill of $150,000.
We're paying for the hotels from the spontaneous donations that people are sending to Annunciation House.
Typically, the migrants stay one or two nights before traveling elsewhere in the U.S. to meet relatives. They are monitored by ICE and must appear before a severely backlogged immigration court at a future date. Most families are fleeing violence and extreme poverty. For NPR News, I'm Monica Ortiz Uribe in El Paso.
This is NPR News.
Next week brings two new Armed Services Committee chairmen, one in the Senate, a Republican.
Our number one priority in this country should be defense.
The other in the House, a Democrat.
If you spend that much money on defense, the debt and the deficit grow ever higher.
I'm Ari Shapiro, dueling defense chairman and the latest on the government shutdown this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Hear All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30. That's right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD HD.
Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. NPR News and Classical Music.
Morning Edition on WPR, and a news update from NPR is next. In WPR's newscast, Corrine Hess reports that Milwaukee County is considering growing industrial hemp. That story and more just ahead. Stay with us.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. This is day 7 of the partial shutdown of the federal government. There's no word of any movement in the budget impasse between the White House and Congress. President Trump wants $5 billion for a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. The House has approved the funds, the Senate has not. Thousands of federal employees deemed essential are working without pay. They include the TSA and the Coast Guard. Others are furloughed. A judge in Pennsylvania is giving Mumia Abu-Jamal another chance to appeal his conviction in the shooting death of a Philadelphia police officer. That was back in 1981. Bobby Allen with member station WHYY says the ruling comes 6 years after the state Supreme Court said no.
Abu-Jamal's lawyers say this is the best shot at freedom he's had in decades. One of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court justices that repeatedly denied his petitions was formerly the district attorney of Philadelphia. In that role, he fought to keep Abu-Jamal in prison. The judge says that's a conflict of interest and Abu-Jamal deserves a new hearing.
Abu-Jamal spent nearly 3 decades on Pennsylvania's death row. In 2011, his sentence was thrown out because of flawed jury instructions. Prosecutors later agreed to life in prison. The National Weather Service has posted flood watches and warnings from Louisiana to New Jersey. Up to a foot of rain has fallen along the Gulf Coast. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is news from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:31 now. I'm Melissa Ingalls. A criminal case against two former University of Wisconsin Oshkosh officials is set for the spring. Former UWO Chancellor Richard Wells and former Vice Chancellor Thomas Sunleitner face felony charges. The two are accused of telling lenders the university would back loans for several real estate deals made through the UWO Foundation. The UW system agreed late last week to pay $6.3 million to two lenders. It could have been on the hook for $15 million. That's according to Miles McGuire, a UWO journalism professor and editor of the website The Oshkosh Examiner. He says the two former administrators may use the settlement to their advantage.
The criminal case is still alive against Wells and Sunleitner, but if you take out that argument that what they were doing was illegal, that certainly, I think, problematizes and complicates the criminal case against them.
An attorney for the UW Oshkosh Foundation says the organization is on sound financial footing. WPR is a service of UW-Madison. Milwaukee County could soon join a growing number of groups exploring the business of industrial hemp. As Corrine Hess reports, the county may grow and process hemp at the Domes Horticultural Conservatory.
The aging domes have about $30 million worth of maintenance that's been put off. County Board Supervisor Sylvia Ortiz-Velez says exploring the hemp business could raise some of the money needed for those repairs.
The whole hope is to save the dome. If we have one greenhouse and we can make $2 or $3 million out of there, even if it's leasing the space because it's such a unique place and the researchers will pay money for a controlled environment like that. It's a way for us to, you know, maybe have like a, you know, revenue without raising taxes.
The county is considering several options, including seed certification, education, or research for the federal government. The 2018 Farm Bill legalized industrial hemp after decades of restrictions. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
A new study finds University of Wisconsin-Madison Division I athletes are in better mental shape than their classmates. Tracy Snedden, a nursing professor who led the study, says Division I athletes have more resources, including tutors, psychologists, and trainers. She says non-athletes may struggle with a lack of health insurance or a lack of time to deal with illnesses.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Focus Features, presenting Mary, Queen of Scots. A rebellious young queen stops at nothing to reclaim her throne. Saoirse Ronan and Margot Robbie star as warring queens, now playing in theaters everywhere. And from iDrive, maker of Remote PC, promoting real-time remote access to PCs, Macs, and servers from anywhere, for use when telecommuting or for remote management. Learn more at remotepc.com/NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noel King.
And I'm David Green. The federal government remains partially shut down this morning, and it does not look like the White House and Congress are any closer to an agreement over President Trump's demand for a border wall. Now, this is affecting federal employees in different ways. In the agencies affected, some people are working and will likely get paid for the time later. Some are furloughed, and in the past, they have gotten back pay later on as well. But for contract workers, it is grim. Many are out of work indefinitely and might not get paychecks at all. That includes 71-year-old Lila Johnson. She does cleaning work overnight at the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
We have floor men that keep the floors clean, you know, the ladies cleaning bathroom. You got people cleaning the area, making it safe for the people to walk when they come back to work.
But not right now. The Agriculture Department is partially shut down, and Lila Johnson's supervisor told her not to come in, which has been really difficult because she's the breadwinner in her family and also takes care of two great-grandchildren.
It's hard on me right now because I got everything, you know, hit me. I got car note, insurance, life insurance, rent. I have food to put on the table for the children, myself. And it's just hard. I have other bills to pay.
And I want to bring in another voice now. It's Jaime Contreras. He is vice president of the SEIU, 32BJ Service Workers Union, which represents federal contract workers, including Lila Johnson. They put us in contact with her as well. He is in our studios here in Washington. Welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
So how typical is Lila Johnson's situation?
I mean, Lila Johnson is one story of 71 at the Department of Agriculture. You have similar stories at State Department where people were let go. They were told not to come to work, and those people are not sure if they're going to get paid or not.
How many do you think in total are we talking about in all the agencies that are affected?
Well, in this area, our union represents around 2,000 contracted out workers at federal agencies. In this particular cycle of government shutdown, it's close to 800 workers.
800 or so.
You know, we have 400 security officers that keep the Smithsonian institutions safe. Their funding runs out next Tuesday. They have no idea what's going to happen after that. And that's just not, it's not fair. It's not right. It's not what we should be doing for the people who keep our buildings, our federal buildings safe and clean.
And it sounds like Lila Johnson, I mean, she really relies on these paychecks to help her great-grandchildren, to put food on the table, I mean, to pay the rent. How long can a lot of these workers go without money coming in and without the prospect of knowing when they'll get money?
Well, these are workers who already work two jobs in order to be able to maintain their households. These are people who live paycheck to paycheck. They have, for the most part, no savings because they spend all their money. One day that you don't get paid, it has an effect on their livelihood. Some people have to borrow money from other relatives. Some people have to call their bank and say, hey, I'm going to be late because I'm not getting paid. And some of these corporations work with you, some of them won't. And so they start accumulating late fees and they have to deal with that mess. So it's just wrong. It's wrong to do that to people. Working families, whether you're black, brown, white, I mean, we want a government that works. We want people who are going to be able to make deals and put people and country in front of politics. And that's not what we have in this country at this moment.
Well, President Trump has, you know, has said, he's made this claim that the people who have been impacted by this understand the need for the shutdown. He says that they understand that he needs to fight for border security. What are you hearing from the workers who you represent?
I absolutely disagree with that. I mean, if you talk to any of the workers understand that this president, this administration is playing games with their livelihoods. And for him to continue to push an issue that he knows is not going to get support in the Senate, and even though he has his friends of the Freedom Caucus in the House, you know, why don't you sign that bipartisan compromise that was done a week or so ago? And not put the country and people through this mess that we're in right now.
Some have blamed Democrats as well. I mean, saying they have really dug in on this issue and there are things that they could do to compromise, figure out some sort of barrier to give President Trump a little bit of what he wants, actually negotiate. I mean, are some of your workers actually pointing the finger at both sides and saying, come on, Washington, like, just come up with something so we can get back to work here?
There's always finger pointing to both sides, but we know who's in charge. The fact of the matter, if Republicans control the House, they control the Senate, they're in charge in the White House. They don't want to compromise. I mean, the president said it on national TV. I'll be proud to shut down the government over the border wall.
Has your union been able to do anything to help some of these workers as they've been going through this?
We were working with some of our, you know, allies in the community. Through the Labor Council here in D.C., we have the Community Services Agency who is taking collections for our members to try to help them cope through this mess until they, you know, our wonderful politicians figure out what to do with opening up the government, which right now is completely uncertain. Until we have a new Congress, these workers are living in limbo.
What kind of work did you do before taking over a leadership job at the union?
Well, you know, one of the things that makes it a little more personal for me is because, you know, I'm an immigrant. I came to this country in 1988 during the Civil War in El Salvador. I came here undocumented. My parents had no choice but to bring me undocumented. Since then, I became a citizen. I serve in the United States Navy, and I've been working for the union for over 23 years now. But I started as a rank-and-file cleaner at 1800 M Street many, many years ago. And so,
it's a building in Washington, D.C.
It's a building in Washington, D.C. So I was a cleaner. This, to me, is personal because it's when I served this country in the U.S. military as a veteran, to me, it's offensive what this president is doing, vilifying immigrants. Make this wall the top priority of his administration when immigrants, everybody knows, have and continue to contribute in so many ways to this economy, to this country, to the culture. It's not a reason to shut down the government. It's not a reason to put regular working people like Lila Johnson and others at risk of losing their homes, paying their bills, or feeding their families.
Jaime Contreras is the vice president of the SEIU 32BJ Service Workers Union that represents many of the federal contract workers who are put out of work right now as part of the partial government shutdown. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And looking ahead to later this afternoon and all things considered, lawmakers will take up two bills that would tax carbon emissions when they go back to work next week. Energy companies back these measures, so what's different this time? You can listen by asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your local member station by name. This is NPR News.
Good morning. It's 8:42. I'm Melissa Ingalls, and you're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. As the year winds down, Morning Edition is asking people about which song was their favorite from 2018. Coming up, Bob Boylan, host of All Songs Considered, shares his favorite song. You'll find out in 9 minutes.
The BBC News presenters are terrific interviewers. They ask good and meaningful questions, but they're also very funny.
Cheaty ante to the photo that was disqualified from a prestigious wildlife photography competition for allegedly using a stuffed animal.
And all of that we get every single afternoon.
Join Brady Carlson every weekday for WPR News on BBC NewsHour at 3 and during All Things Considered at 4 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin-Madison, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
Support for WGTD comes from Piasecki Althaus. Since 1931, Piasecki Althaus has provided unmatched, compassionate service and are dedicated to your family, guests, and supporting the community. Piasecki Althaus Funeral Home, honoring personal legacies and the circle of life. 262-658-4101.
This is Morning Edition on WPR, and here are some of the headlines we're following today. The Kremlin has welcomed the Syrian military's entry into the Flashpoint Kurdish-held town where Turkey has threatened an offensive. The Syrian entry into the town comes a day before Moscow is to host top Turkish officials to discuss the crisis in Syria after the U.S. announced it will withdraw its troops from the country. It's looking increasingly like the partial government shutdown will be handed off to a divided government to solve. This as agreement eludes Washington in the waning days of the Republican monopoly on power. Now nearly a week old, the impasse is idling hundreds of thousands of federal workers and beginning to pinch citizens who count on varied public services. We'll have all the latest news for you in 15 minutes from NPR and WPR, and there's more news on our website. Go to WPR.org. In weather for today, cloudy skies, areas of rain, and mixed rain and snow will turn to all snow this afternoon, up to 2 inches of accumulation possible in the south, highs in the 30s and 40s.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Focus Features, presenting Mary, Queen of Scots. A rebellious young queen stops at nothing to reclaim her throne. Saoirse Ronan and Margot Robbie star as warring queens, now playing in theaters everywhere. And from Visiting Angels, professional caregivers assisting adults in bathing, dressing, meals, and light housework nationwide. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Office locations are at visitingangels.com.
It's 8:45 now, and time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maury McCollum with a look back on 2018 with Charlie Behrens.
Geez Louise, comedian Charlie Behrens has had a huge year. As host of the Manitowoc Minute, he's performing sold-out shows across Wisconsin, and his online comedy news show is continuing to rack up tens of thousands of views. I recently caught up with Behrens to talk more about 2018.
Hey, dear folks, the Manitowoc Minute is one of the greatest news shows in all Wisconsin, the most trusted news show on Facebook, right up there next to Dem Russians. Keep her moving.
So you're back for the holidays. How's that been?
It's been cool. It's been fun coming up with another hour of material. And, you know, Wisconsin's kind of the thing, like, can you do the Wisconsin character? And how far can you go with that? And I'm always surprised by, like, the deeper I go, the more material there is. It's like exponential material.
There's, like, a constant hunger for people in Wisconsin wanting to make fun of themselves.
I think so.
This week's episode's brought to you by Stump Lake Liquor and Fireworks. Liquor and fireworks, they got it all. The only thing that's missing is your finger. Oh, that's why they call it Stump Lake.
What is it that Charlie Behrens likes to do when he's in Wisconsin with his family?
So we have a big celebration Christmas Eve. Like, I'm one of 12 kids, so everybody gets together. We exchange gifts, and this is my favorite part. We exchange a gift with somebody who we picked at Thanksgiving, but then we do this, like, roast of them. So it's like you get them a gift, but nobody really cares about the gift. They all just spend time, like, really trying to find the best roast of their sibling or mother, father, or whatever. So that's one of my favorite parts
about
Christmas.
That's very precious.
Yeah.
So 2018 was a big year for you personally,
yeah.
But I've always wondered how you walk that fine line between bringing your personal views into either, whether it's on Twitter or through the Manitowoc Minute, but also not completely alienating this, like, very broad audience that you have.
I think a lot about that. What I am focusing on are issues that I believe, whether you're on the right or the left, we can agree on these things. You know, we can agree that racism is bad. We can agree the environment is good. We can agree that our troops do so much for us. It's important to honor them. I'm having conversations all the time with people on the right and people on the left because they come to the meet and greets after the show. And I feel like I'm getting a sense of where people are at. And nobody is at the Sean Hannity level. You know, nobody is at the Matt Owl, you know, the MSNBC Fox kind of thing, or nobody's there, you know? And those guys, I feel like, do a lot of damage because they are riling people up. For what reason? We need to find common ground. Your ratings should not be important enough that they start pitting people against each other.
And I thought you handled the Baraboo High School photo incident.
This guy, that's not a wave. Okay, calling that a wave is like calling a Mercedes a Toyota. Yeah, they're both cars, but only one was used by Hitler. That's a history joke. Speaking of history, we got to start taking it more seriously in high school and college before we repeat it.
I think you have to address an issue like that, see it for what it is, acknowledge it, and learn from it.
Hate can't fix hate. Only love can. I know that because I read it on the back of a Subaru last week.
I mean, you've had such a crazy year going to Lambeau, going to Miller Park during the playoffs. You have this beer named after you.
Yeah.
I, like, walk down the streets and I see people wearing their, like, Keep Removing T-shirts.
Nice.
I mean, that's crazy.
It is crazy.
So I'm wondering, for you personally, is it hard to balance who you are with your character? Like, even in this conversation, it's
say,
like, where does Manitowoc Minute Dude end, and where does Charlie Barron's begin?
It couldn't, I don't think, come across as authentic if it wasn't a serious part of me and who I am and, you know, how I grew up.
Well, thank you so much, Charlie, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, and keep her moving. Also, as always, go Packers and f*** the Bears.
Comedian Charlie Barron's is the creator of Manitowoc Minute. And if you want to hear our full conversation, check out WPR's Beta. There, you can hear us talk about the biggest stories of the year, like climate change and the Packers. Just go to WPR.org/beta. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Support for WGTD comes from Classic Violins, the premier southeastern Wisconsin workshop for violin family instruments. Master Luthier, always on premises. ClassicViolins.com, 262-577-5488.
Cool day. It's the news from diverse angles. It's voices that matter. It's the context you need to really understand. Start your day fully awake with Morning Edition. Listen every day.
You're listening to Morning Edition on WPR, and the program is almost over for today, but stay with us. Stephanie Elkins will be in just after 9 with classical music for you. Eduard Lalo's Symphonie Española is on the program today, as well as a horn concerto by Rossetti, music for cello and piano by Chopin, and a suite by Camille Saint-Saëns. That music and more after news from NPR and WPR at the top of the hour.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noelle King.
And I'm David Green. So what were the best songs of 2018? Well, not surprisingly, opinions vary wildly. But let's check out one favorite from a co-host of NPR's All Songs Considered.
I'm Bob Boylan. Before the end of 2017, I knew I'd just heard my favorite song of 2018. I'd never been so sure. Night Shift from Lucy Dacus is a 6 minute and 32 second post-breakup song that extends a hand of hope after a virtual scream into a pillow.
The first time I tasted somebody else's spit, I had a coughing fit.
Lucy Dacus is a 23-year-old singer based in Richmond, Virginia. I was first attracted to her voice. It has a well-worn husk that adds heft to her stories of loss and death.
I'm doing fine, trying to derail my one-track mind, regaining my self-worth in record time.
If you listen, you can hear the song's quiet subtlety. But as the story unfolds, the tone of the tune goes from spellbinding to a sonic burst of guitars and more. Lucy Dacus told me that for a long time, I didn't believe expressing this sort of negativity was productive, but it's less productive to resist the truths of a situation. And so she wrote Night Shift. And as Night Shift nears its end and she imagines the years gone by, her look back on this bad relationship is hopeful. And that hopefulness is ever present, not just on Night Shift, which is my favorite song of 2018, but on her album Historian, which is my favorite album of 2018.
That was Bob Boylan from NPR Music giving us his favorite song of 2018, which is Night Shift by Lucy Dacus.
As 2018 comes to a close, we're going to take a moment to remember some of the musicians we lost this year. Here is our annual musical montage.
magic number. Yes, it is. It's a magic number.
Plus I know it's a beautiful feeling. And oblivion, yeah, yeah. Oblivion, yeah, yeah. La Boheme. La Boheme. Ça voulait dire on est heureux.
Trumpeter Roy Hargrove concludes our montage tribute to some of the musicians we lost in 2018. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was written by BJ Lederman and arranged by Jim Pugh. I'm Noel King.
And I'm David Green.
I'm Melissa Ingalls. You can hear Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Join us at 3 for more of the day's news on BBC NewsHour, followed by All Things Considered at 4. It's a minute before 9. Stay with us. News from NPR and WPR is next, and then classical music with Stephanie Elkins.
Morning Edition. All Things Considered. Simply Folk. These programs and many more are possible thanks to listener support. You can learn about WPR programs, schedules, and so much more at WPR.org.
Support for WGTD comes from Leeward Elite. Shorten your workday, reduce stress, and re-engage with the joy of mission by removing the pain of technology. 5723 6th Avenue, Kenosha. For more information, visit leewardba.com.
You're listening to WGTD.